Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Australian and New Zealand Studies channel on the New Books Network. Before we begin today, I would like to pay my respects to the First Nations people of Australia, past, present and emerging. Today we have with us Stuart Rees, who will be discussing his book Cruelty or Humanity, published by Policy Press, which is an imprint of the Bristol University Press 2020. Stuart is Emeritus Professor at the University of Sydney, and he's associated with the Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies. Prior to that, Stuart was, for I think more than two decades, a professor in social work and social policy, and now lives near a beautiful beach south of Sydney, and dedicates his time to peace and conflict studies. So good afternoon, Stuart.
Good afternoon, Pete. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. Now, before we begin discussing your book, could you introduce yourself to our audience and provide a background to yourself and what got you interested in the peace and conflict studies area?
Sure. Look, I was, I suppose I'm a human rights activist as much as I am an academic. I worked in the Central Criminal Court in London for many years. I worked for the Attorney General in Western Canada for several years. I worked in the War on Poverty programs in the 60s in the United States, and then went back to Scotland, did a PhD, finished up eventually in Sydney University as professor of social work and social policy with sociology thrown in. But my philosophy has involved me in saying and acting as though I should spend 51% of my time outside the walls of the university, so that I took pretty seriously the relationship between theory and practice, in particular in areas of human rights, peace negotiations, social welfare, and so on. I hope that's not too long-winded.
No, that's good. And out of interest, have you ever been arrested for your activities?
Yes, I've been arrested in for taking part in an illegal demonstration in Berkeley, California. I used to teach at the University of California at Berkeley. That was over the Vietnam War, but then lots of us were arrested in those days. But I've never actually been arrested by New South Wales police, even though I've taken part in plenty of demonstrations here, most recently one outside the courts regarding Julian Assange.
Right. Okay. Now, your book is called Cruelty or Humanity. Could you let our audience know what the aim of this book is to begin with?
Well, the book is essentially about the idea, or not the evidence, that in democracies, dictatorships, and theocracies, cruelty is the centerpiece of domestic and foreign policies. even though a great deal of effort goes into denying that that's the case. In other words, I'm arguing that there's really not much difference between democracies and dictatorships in terms of the use of cruelty for powerful politicians, powerful institutions to get their way in life. And I really wrote the book not only because I was appalled by the cruelty, but because I realized that it was never acknowledged that cruelty, that there was a great deal of enthusiasm about cruelty on behalf of people who nevertheless claimed they were good Christians or good Muslims or good Hindus, or even in Australia's case, good mates.
Right. Could I ask you to explain what or how, what's a useful way of considering what cruelty is?
What cruelty is? That's a good question. Look, essentially, it's the wanton imposition of pain and harm on human beings and animals without any possible justification. I mean, that's a simple definition. The word wanton means that there is absolutely no justification for that policy or that behavior. If we looked at all the international laws and covenants that prohibit cruelty, you'd see more specific definitions. So, for example, cruelty in a marriage, cruelty towards children, cruelty towards animals have certain variations, but the common theme is the one that I've just mentioned.
Yes. And equally, how should we consider humanity? The book's called Cruelty or Humanity.
Yeah, that's an equally good question. Really, it's about respect for the interdependence of people and all living things. In other words, it embraces every citizen of the world, every animal, and this precious planet. But a more specific definition would be to look at the 30 clauses of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which, if taken seriously, would represent a commitment to humanity. After all, when it was passed in 1948, it was said to be the highest aspirations of the common man. But you'll probably note that I've also used poetry and music to describe what humanity means.
Yes.
I'll give you a couple of lines from the Aboriginal poet Ujuru Nunukul. I'm for humanity, not coloured jibes. I'm international, never mind tribes. I'm international, never mind place. I'm for humanity, all one race. So that's about as close as I can get.
Yes, understand. Now, there's two points you've raised there I want to come back to as this interview progresses. One is about humanity can be considered at a societal level, also at a more micro individual level. And I do want to talk about the role of poetry in your book. But before there, one question I have is, the book is called Cruelty or Humanity. Is there any exclusivity between those two concepts? Because I imagine people would have a balance of both. I mean, I've said things that I would consider cruel, and I would also consider myself to have some level of humanity.
Well, yeah, that's another good question, Bede. It's really about the way we all use power. At one end of a continuum, a power has been mostly used over the centuries in an abusive way, in a top-down way. You only have to ask Indigenous people and women around the world who know they've been on the receiving end of what I call one-dimensional power, abusive power. The only thing I expect of you in when power is exercised in that way is that you should be obedient and compliant. And it's hardly, and unfortunately, a great deal of politics is played in that way. At the other end of the continuum.
We have Stuart back. We've had to jump to the phone. Unfortunately, there's something wrong with the telephone lines or the computer lines. And in any case, we will proceed now. So my next question, Stuart, is in the book, one of the things that you do is you merge what are atrocities of various descriptions. You merge that or infuse that with various pieces of poetry.
Correct.
At the start of the book, you have this interesting quote from observation from Shelley, the English poet, who said that the poets are the legislators of the world. Now, Shelley, I imagine, would be a good candidate for that because as much as I know about Shelley, he was a bit of a sort of humanist type person. He was vegetarian. He had a very liberal view of life. And I imagine, so if he was the legislator of the world, that would be great. There's probably some other poets you wouldn't want to be the legislators of the world, but the enterprise of poetry as being the legislators of the world, what do you take from that?
I think it's about having a vision of the future. It's about trying to imagine a better world. So that unless you have a vision of the future, whether it's by poetry or great music or great social policies that are committed to human rights, then life becomes just a question of pragmatism and day-to-day survival. So a bit like the architects of the Universal Declaration, Shelley was saying, no, we need vision about an humanitarian future that could be artistic as well.
Right. Okay. Now, next, I would like to investigate the one of the points you raise early in chapter one of the book is you have these you explain how the events of the Holocaust are well known to the public imagination, but there are other atrocious events, including events at similar times, that may not be so well known. And as an Australian, one thing that I at least is a little bit scandalous is we know very little about the famine in Bengal in 1942 and 1943, where 3 million people died. And there was even an Australian governor, R.G. Casey, in charge of that when it was part of British India at the time. Could you talk about the difference between some events that are known and some that just seem to be unknown?
Sure. Well, I think the media at different stages can dramatize certain things and ignore others. So, for example, if you take the Bengal famine, Churchill was largely responsible for that. But the media, certainly in Britain and in Australia, were trying to paint Churchill only as the great, inspiring war leader who could do no wrong. And it's only in retrospect that we realize that he was incredibly cruel in his policies. I mean, he said that the Indian people deserved it because they bred like rabbits. So he was highly racist in that respect. And I don't think there's some evidence in the book that the food, the grain that was intended for the people of Bengal, he determined to have the ships turned away because he said it was better to feed the British than the starving Bengalis. Also, I mean, the other example I give is that very few people knew what has happened to the Palestinians over the decades. It's only recently that the Palestinian side of that story is told. Similarly, most people are unaware of the founding of the Americas, South America, North America, and Australia was based on the elimination of indigenous people. I mean, it was significant that you began this interview with your respect to the indigenous people of Australia. But most people are completely unaware of what the truths are about the colonization of this country.
Yes, that's I was reading a book by the indigenous historian Henry Reynolds, and he has it sounds funny, but it's actually quite tragic how early in 1788, after Australia was founded, six or seven convicts were hung for stealing. And he observes that, well, it's sort of a bit ironic because only a few days before he had single-handedly stolen a continent. And here are these poor convicts being hung for stealing. So yeah. I thought that was quite brought the point you've just raised out quite well. The book focuses on a lot of regimes or gives and sort of events from a lot of harsh regimes in the last half of the 20th century. So, for example, reference is made to Jeffrey Robinson's study of Iran in 1988 when a lot of prisoners were killed. Could you explain the dynamics in countries like that where they're between a political government and also a theocracy?
Yeah, okay. The Western powers agreed, colluded with the eventual disappearance of the Shah, the monarchy that was followed by the Iranian Revolution. I think the West, the Americans, the Australians, the British, didn't expect religion to be immediately dominant as the major consideration of government in Iran. But I think within months, it became apparent that it was. But it's a religion which is an interpretation of religion, which is dogmatic, preoccupied with power, doesn't allow the tolerance that we think we like to expect in so-called democracies. So in a way, the point about a theocracy is that religion and state are all the same thing, whereas most of our experience of government has concerned the desperate attempt to ensure that religion and the state are kept separate. In other words, most of early revolutions were fought on the grounds that religion and state should be separate. But what happened in the theocracies is that they're one and the same thing.
Yes. And you've mentioned power a few times, the role of power in regimes that become cruel. What motivates something that's powerful to become cruel?
Yeah. Look, I've explored, I looked at just about most of the countries of the world and asked myself the question you've just asked me. And it's quite apparent that cruelty is never dished out to people who have been defined as equal to the perpetrators. A process of stigmatization, of defining people as unworthy, as inferior, as inhuman, and in some cases, people are defined as not really existing. So once people have been classified in those terms, this seems to give the powerful an entitlement to do what they like. So, for example, in the case of the Rohingya people in Myanmar, it is a criminal offence to even mention the word Rohingya. They were regarded as not existing. For decades, it was an offence to acknowledge that there were a group of people called Palestinians. I discovered to my cost for many years that you shouldn't really mention the word Palestinian. So once people are defined as unworthy for racist reasons, because of assumptions about superiority, this seems to entitle leaders, so-called leaders, to try to punish, torture, even eliminate the ones who've been defined as unworthy. I mean, the shocking example at the moment, you know, there's just been an election in Israel, and this is the judgment of some of my Israeli colleagues, a right-wing fascist parliament has been elected, and it wants to, it has plans to deport from that country people it doesn't like. You might apply the similar argument to us and our treatment of asylum seekers and refugees by sticking them at enormous cost on remote Pacific islands.
Yes, with refugees in particular, you have a section in the book where you talk about the former Australian Attorney General, Philip Ruddock. And one of the points, and I may not be getting this completely correct, but one of the points you seem to be raising is that he can be considered to be a sort of composite person. You can have elements of policies that people might consider cruel, the way in which asylum seekers were treated, but equally he was a person who was on Amnesty International, so would have been against things like the death penalty and things like that. So within this one individual, there's this striking contrast. Could you talk about that a bit more?
Yeah, well, it's the Jekyll and Hyde characteristics that, you know, you could say lots of us have. The person who is, you know, charming at home, but anything but charming in the workplace. A reflection of the way Philip Ruddock behaved. I mean, he, for example, he was one of the people who claimed that the refugees had thrown their children overboard, when in fact they had not. He was a supporter of the decision to, when the Norwegian freighter, the Tampa, on humanitarian grounds, picked up hundreds of refugees, and brave Australia jumped up and said, via John Howard in that case, but Ruddock was part of his government, you know, we're going to decide who comes to this country and how they travel here, irrespective of the rules of international law. So you've got a lot of contradictions built into the way people behave. And Philip Ruddock was a mass of contradictions. I mean, his daughter was so appalled at his behaviour towards asylum seekers that she left Australia and said, apparently, I can't bear to be here anymore.
Mm. Yes. The book itself, when I read it, I remember I found it quite difficult in the sense that it obviously chronicles a lot of terrible things that have happened over a long periods of time, and it's interspersed with these poems. And the poems, in a way, create, in me at least, an emotional response to the events, but they don't make the event become happy. It just can't become happy. And it might give you reason to reflect on it. When you prepared the book, how did you consider how you would deal with it? Did you ever feel I should put in some uplifting tales from particular countries?
Well, in a way, the book is two essays. The first part is about a record of the past. The second part, which is called Humanitarian Alternatives, is about what you're referring to as the potentially happy part. We have to acknowledge the past, because as you've mentioned in the previous question, many of the atrocities and mass murders are barely known by people. But unless we acknowledge the past, we can't face up to the future. And Kevin Rudd's apology to the Indigenous people of Australia was one attempt, a kind of watershed attempt to recognize certain aspects of this country's past. Look, there are all sorts of references, not just to poetry, but to music, and in a way, to prepare myself for the second part of the book, which is to say, what sort of humanitarian utopia can you possibly build? And I think it was George Bernard Shaw said that. No, it was W.B. Yeats who said that. If you're going to talk about a better future, you have to imagine some sort of utopian conditions. And I think the ambivalence and the contradictions that we've just talked about with regard to Ruddock, in a way, the romantic English poet Wordsworth, when he observed the cruelty of the Industrial Revolution, he had that in mind. He said, what a fair world were ours for verse to paint, if power could live at ease with self-restraint. So you've always got the germ of what you've referred to as happiness to a far more humanitarian world. The germ is always there. it's in some people's DNA, and we just have to have the policies and the dialogue to achieve it.
Yes. On the same page where you have that quote from Wordsworth, you have an extract from Judith Wright's poem, Two Dream Times, which I thought was a beautiful poem, a beautiful extract you have there. Could you talk about, I don't know if you can recall, it'd be good if you could read it.
Sure, sure.
And what that says to you.
Well, the two dream times, she was very close friend of Ujuru Nunukul, the Kath Walker, the indigenous poet. So it's in a way the two dream times are the Aboriginal woman's dreams and the white poet Judith Wright. She's saying that she acknowledges that despite this beautiful planet, she was the Aboriginal person, was the victim of rape, of human rights abuses, of the stealing of land, of faceless stockbrokers who wanted to invest at your expense. And the alternative dream time is about humor and love and enormous respect for the beauties of the Australian environment, because Judith Wright, among other things, was a great campaigner, perhaps the first campaigner, to protect the Great Barrier Reef. She was long before the campaign to protect what's left of a precious planet. Judith Wright, in addition to being a famous poet and a great friend of Ujuru Nunukul, was a campaigner to protect the Great Barrier Reef. So that's another part of the dream time.
Yes, and when I read that extract, I thought, gosh, this lady, Judith Wright, she gets Australia. There's something about her that just gets this country.
No, it's a good point. It's a good point. When she's passionate about the Australian environment, the spirituality, the physicality of it, and, I can quote poems of hers which elaborate that, which need to be as much a part of the dialogue as politics.
Mm. The book moves on to talk about what at least in social psychology are called total institutions, and you refer to things like the Magdalene laundries in Ireland and atrocities where it seems to me the concept is, if people are put into an environment, one, they can be abused by the people who are the chiefs, as it were, of the environment. But secondly, the people who are abused just come to accept that. That's just, in a way, there's no escape. That's just their life. Could you explain the role of this, what you mean by this total institution concept?
Well, it's what the sociologists called internalization. If you're constantly demeaned and punished and locked up, many people internalize it to the point where they think that their rejection should become self-rejection. In other words, they can justify their own humiliation. And look, for decades, unmarried mothers, because the Magdalena laundry in Ireland is just one example, unmarried mothers were treated abominably. And eventually, a few years ago, Julia Gillard, when she was Prime Minister, and Gordon Brown in the UK when he was Prime Minister, made abject apologies to tens of thousands of unmarried mothers whose children had been taken away from them without them, in many cases, ever being consulted. So it's part of the stigmatization. The unmarried mother was regarded as a completely unworthy person. I mean, the morality of that age, and it's only changed very recently in some parts of the world, it hasn't changed at all. You know, I mean, you can go to countries where unmarried mothers are put in prison for 10 years, or if they have a miscarriage and they're not married, and I'm thinking about El Salvador, you can finish up in jail for almost for life.
But
your question is about the institutionalization. I mean, everybody in a way becomes affected by the institutions in which they spend most of their waking hours.
Yes. A poet who might actually be the poet you cite the most in his work, or she'll at least be close to it, is Denise Levertov. And there are some very moving poems that seem to contrast, well, that you'll explain, for example, atrocities that occurred in the South, a lot of those Americans began South Asian wars, Vietnam, and then Denise will have a poem, and some of them are just very moving. And what do you? I just wanted to ask you your thoughts on her work and how it affects someone's emotion when they consider events like that.
Yeah, well, it's related to your earlier question about, you know, what do people know, what do they not know? I mean, I think most people didn't know about the atrocities being committed in Vietnam. We were frequently told, I lived in America at the time, that the body count was mostly in favor of the United States. In other words, they were killing more people than they had casualties. The point about Denise Levertov, an amazing poet, is that she actually went to Vietnam and observed direct. Well, this isn't secondhand poetry. So those poems about, you know, what do I do with a woman who's had her left arm shot off? What do I do mm-hmm. with the, how do I respond to the child who's just been napalmed? Incredibly powerful. I mean, some of the best poems about peace in the world were written by Denise Levertov following the time she spent in Vietnam. But it's back to Shelley's notion about vision. She grounded her poetry in the direct observation of events and wrote about it in a kind of multidimensional way, because good poetry sometimes is more effective than good prose. You've mentioned in your question about the emotional response that the poetry can provoke, and that happens with poetry better than with prose.
Yeah. Yes, and with Denise in particular, one thing I wanted to ask, the first poem you have cited from her is, I'm just looking up the name now, it's called In Thai Ba, which means peace province.
Yep.
And she has this wonderful beginning where it says, I've used up all my film on bombed hospitals, bombed village schools, the scattered lemon yellow cocoons at the bombed silk factory. And I wanted to ask you, Stuart, is this some sort of, we're now talking about this poem, so it obviously has had some effect on the world. We're sitting in Australia and talking about this poem, but it seems to be almost a lament by her or a frustration that it was as though all she could do was just watch this, and there was nothing else, using up her film.
Yeah, look, I think you've picked up the message. I mean, she's saying, "I'm in a state of despair. I've used up all my film, I've made all my observations, I've cried all my tears, and still this massive cruelty is going on. I'm not sure what to do next." You know, I did an interview the other 2 days, 48 hours ago, with a young man who was ringing me up, talking to me by Zoom from Myanmar. And he said, "What, you know, Professor Rees, what do we do? We're being shot." She said, "You keep on talking about nonviolence, but we're being shot. What are we supposed to do?" And that sense of despair in his question is really what colors Denise Levertov's poems in Vietnam. And if you went to Washington D.C. to raise those sorts of questions during Vietnam, you got denial. And because one of the things in the book is that I came across how much effort was made by powerful people to deny that cruelty had ever occurred. And so when people are denying that something happens, you know pretty certainly that it happened.
Yes. Now, changing tack slightly, the book progresses and you have a section where you discuss deliberate violence by the state in the sense of things like execution of people. And you talk about the case of Andrew Chan, who was an Australian in Indonesia, executed in 2015. And one of the points you make is that the state was so able to clinically kill this person, and the state just did not seem to have, the state itself didn't seem to have the mental capacity, the legal ability to even consider the concept of mercy. Could you talk about that?
Look, those executions were plain evil, and we have to, I've had to negotiate in all sorts of conflict situations around the world. You have to draw a line in the sand. You have to call things for what they are. And that government, in common with lots of governments, including Australia's attitude to asylum seekers, where you think of the family of four with the two little girls being stuck on Christmas Island for an absolutely bizarre episode in Australian history for more than a year. Unless we have the kind of conversation that you and I are having now regarding this book, unless there's dialogue, then the alternative, the pathway to mercy, the idea of power being used in a non-abusive, non-destructive way doesn't occur. You know, I must have, in my career, talked to thousands of politicians and thousands of military commanders in different countries whose understanding about what the alternative ways to use their power are is very limited, partly because the kind of conversation we're having about what the alternatives are don't occur. So that for decades, powerful people have saved face. They didn't want to be merciful to Andrew Chan and his friend, because it would look as though the government was being weak. It didn't. It would have to save face. It wanted to bang its chest and appear powerful, and that's partly why why capital punishment is retained in so many countries still.
Mm. When I think of the concept of mercy, I often think of it as having a relationship to the concept of justice. And there's lots of talk about how those two things can work together, or if they can or if they can't. It seems, though, from the way in which you describe Andrew Chan's story, it's not as though the alternative to mercy here is justice, because I think you would say what happened to him wasn't just. So in a context like that, how does mercy work?
Well, I mean, I take my friend Archbishop Desmond Tutu's philosophy, which was no future without forgiveness. Can you still hear me? Okay, because they've gone off. I can't see you anymore. Yeah, no future without forgiveness. So what was to be lost by the Indonesian government deciding to forgive? Because justice is an elusive concept. It's always, in a way, we are struggling to achieve justice almost every day of the week. What is fair and just within the family, in the workplace, on the streets, in the conduct of non-government organizations, in state governments, in international relations? You know, it's I always just go back to the blueprint for justice, the international blueprint, which is the 30 clauses of the Universal Declaration. And you could say it's a struggle to identify what freedom means and how it can be experienced. Whereas the constant use of prisons, if you take the United States, for example, imprisons more people per capita than anywhere else in the world. They love prisons. They're fascinated with prisons. And yet, as you enter New York Harbor, there's a statue that says that this country is the land of the free. So the complete contradiction between the fascination with punishment and prisons and the false claim that it's the land of the free. I mean, the only thing we can do is talk about it, is to bring to people's attention the contradiction.
Yes. And it seems to me you would have your work cut out. The peace activists of the world would have their work cut out for them, because the examples you give in relation to executions, you go through a lot of states that where execution is relatively common: Saudi Arabia, the United States, China, Iran, and Pakistan. And in each of those countries, I imagine that the children, as each generation rolls through, they will be taught this is just what you do when someone misbehaves. In sure, what we sure. deem misbehavior. So how as a human, how can it resolve itself in what? How could you imagine going to a country like that in 100 years and not seeing executions? What needs to happen?
Well, there has to be. I mean, for centuries, it's mostly men, and it's mostly tribal customs. Got very little to do with religion, even though religion is used to justify what happens in so many places. But men have this old idea of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. In other words, if you're offended, you seek revenge. That's a very primitive notion of justice. There's hardly any future. We'd be constantly at war with one another if that was the principle for conducting business. And I mean, the personal is the political. I've been involved in negotiations about domestic violence. And in a way, domestic violence is the minuscule example of international wars, because the powerful can think of no other way except to try to obliterate and beat into submission those whom they offend. There's an alternative agenda. There's an alternative vision. It says, in my philosophy, we're only on the planet for 5 minutes. Is that really a way you wish to live your life? I mean, you and I could discuss the wonderful poetry of Denise Levertov, the music you like, the music the people who might listen to this broadcast like. None of those people are going to say, I wish I'd killed more people. I wish I'd tortured more people. But the people in positions of power and seem to think that they can only think about exercising power in that top-down, destructive way. And it's partly Bede about a language. You know, in my view, they are mostly highly illiterate about nonviolence. When I go to Canberra, when I go to Washington or Westminster, I listen to a lot of people who are very literate about violence, but highly illiterate about nonviolence.
Now, the book has some very good sections, I think, on animals and animal cruelty. And it presents a picture of animals as being, you spoke about this earlier, as animals being this class of people who are, or not people, but class of beings that are deemed to be inferior, and that then justifies cruelty toward them in a way. And you even then explain how within animals there are different classes of animals. So there's domestic pets that you can't kill, but then there are farmed animals where you can kill them, and the way in which you can treat them can be horrible. Can you talk about what you thought was important, why it was important to include those sections?
Yeah, well, I thought it would be absurd, wrong, almost immoral to talk about cruelty to human beings if I didn't address the question of cruelty to animals. And you can hardly talk about the philosophy and practice of nonviolence if you decide that it's a good idea to put 3,000 sheep in a ship and ship it and send it to the Middle East, and knowing that one third of them are likely to die of suffocation on the way, and that, or if you look at the the terrible record of cruelty to animals for sport purposes in many parts of the world. But even the cruelty that goes into zoos, even the cruelty that was publicized with regard to greyhound racing and the preparation of greyhounds to run fast at the expense of rabbits and other live animals. We can't talk about an humanitarian alternative unless it includes man's best friend, the dog, and all the other creatures. If you think of the consequences of the bushfires, I mean, millions of animals lost their lives in Australia. They are we live in an interdependent world. If we decide to eliminate one part of it, the planet, you know, in David Attenborough's terms, it won't exist.
Yes, and with animals, it raises a more a very difficult issue for, I imagine, for lots of people. Where we're talking about Andrew Chan a moment ago, who was executed in Indonesia. And he could have been treated very well in prison and then executed, but I don't think that would, in your judgment, mean his execution somehow became uncruel. It was the fact that he was killed. So if I happen to be hungry tonight and I decide, well, I'm hungry, I'm going to go and eat a chicken burger, am I in a sense being cruel but not knowing it by thinking just because I'm hungry, an animal should die for that when I could just as easily have something that doesn't involve killing a chicken? So how would you?
Yeah, that's a difficult moral dilemma. I have to admit that I'm not a vegetarian, for example, and there's certainly a strong argument that if we want to be serious about preserving planet Earth, if we want to be part of the extinction rebellion, in other words, people rebelling against the prospect of all living things becoming extinct, then you probably would have to look for a vegetarian burger instead of a chicken burger on those grounds. I mean, I think the awareness of cruelty to animals, if you take, for example, the racing industry, I think, again, it's a bit like your reference earlier to atrocities that people didn't know about. I think the cruelty to the animal world is largely an unknown.
Yes, very well hidden. And then from moving from animals, it's almost as though you're making a sort of ironic contrast where then you then talk a little bit about how there have been some just massive changes in, so when Palestine was, the West, people were moved to the West Bank, and you talk about 700,000 people being moved and 500 villages destroyed. And it just seems as though the observation you're making is, well, these people are in a way just being treated the way we treat animals. What's your view on that?
Yeah, look, I've spent quite a lot of time on many visits to refugee camps throughout the Middle East, but also in Burma and so on. I experienced the consequences of terrible cruelty. Beautiful people stuck in a refugee camp in, it's called Burj Al Barajni in the suburbs of Beirut. These are largely people from the Galilee. They were farmers. They've been there for over 20 years. It's a place of about between 20 and 30,000 people now, mostly where the main road is about a meter wide. It's basically an alleyway down which sewage flows. And the leader of that camp said to me, "We only want the chance to prove that we are human beings." Now, We've locked up these people. We've pretended that it was never a problem. And there are now millions of refugees in those camps as a consequence of what is called the Nakba, in the Palestinians' terms, the tragedy of their homes being taken. I've been in many of the shacks that they live in, and they still have the keys to the and the papers of the homes that were taken from them in 1948. That massive dispossession of a whole people is perhaps the biggest, has been the biggest cancer, the biggest primary site of a cancer in international relations since the Second World War.
Yes, it's terrible. Now, our time is running out, Stuart. I would like to ask you, with your work, I imagine you have an aim, what you would like a reader, hopefully, to take away from this. And I don't imagine it's just learning about these facts. I think your book is, I mean, I could be wrong, is directed to calling people to some form of understanding or change or doing something. Could you explain to our audience what you think the reader should be doing, what you would ideally like the reader to do when they turn the last page of your book?
Yeah, great question. Look, I want people to be able to imagine a better world, and to imagine a better world around the world. We have to have the language with which to talk about it. If we don't have the language to talk about it, it's difficult to paint the vision in Shelley's terms. And the better world, the language has got to be about redefining what we mean by humanity. It was almost your first question. In other words, imagine that you can't define humanity unless you pay attention to the task of nuclear disarmament and a totally different policy regarding global warming. You can't imagine a better world unless you redefine what you mean by what we mean by human rights. People think it's a preserve of lawyers. I think you're a lawyer. Human rights is something that we discuss, that you can deal with in the home, on the streets, in the school, in the learning place, in work, and so on, every day of the week. So we have to reimagine what is meant by human rights. And we have to reimagine what is meant by politics. People say to me, well, I'm not interested in politics. And I say, well wait a minute, did you grow up in a family? They say, yes. And I then ask them, was there ever any conflict in your family? I mean, in other words, we've all grown up as a consequence of power plays that are the politics of the family. And that politics, that familiarity with power play, and we're trying to deal with it in Canberra right at this moment in saying women have been abused, women have been treated as second-class citizens, and that attitude has to change dramatically. And that's just another part of my plea in the book for imagining a better world. You know, we can think about it in terms of, you know, your hospitality to me in doing this interview. We can think about it in terms of music we like and poetry we like and great art and great cooking and great fashion. Those are all crucial dimensions of humanity that should enter into political and international dialogue. My concern in imagining a better world is that the very opposite of what Trump meant when he said America, make America great again, is the very opposite of that. And it's the very opposite of the criminal stupidity of the British when they voted for Brexit. I don't know if that's sufficiently optimistic to end on.
No, but the point's made. Now, we will have to wrap up soon, Stuart. So would you please let our audience know what you're working on at the moment?
Okay, well, that's a good question. I'm working on a couple of things right at this moment. I'm looking at the gun culture in America that allows people, large numbers of people, to be slaughtered with guns almost as though it's taken for granted. And I'm trying to address the American reading public and to saying this is you can't claim that you are exceptional and not address this violent culture that you all live through. The second thing I'm working on concerns a massive issue of freedom and respect for human rights in Australia at the moment. It's about the behaviour of the Australian Federal Police, of ASIO, mostly invisible, of probably Peter Dutton and his department in abusing their power, but trying to be deceitful about the way they abuse power. And it's not easy, but I intend to pursue those issues in the next few weeks.
Great. Well, thank you for your time today, Stuart. Thank you for joining us. Your book, Cruelty or Humanity, is available now through Policy Press, published through the Bristol University Press, and I think it's available in Australia through New South Books.
Yeah.
Once again, thank you very much for your time and for giving us this book to read.
Pete, thank you. Thank you for your interest and for conducting this interview. I enjoyed talking to you.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.